The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
We're here with Cherry Cookson, who has a had a career spanning over 30 years in radio drama. First of all, how did you get into radio drama? Was it something you always knew you wanted to do?
No, very roundabout way. I'm very lucky, and when I look back on my career, I realise that everything has just sort of fallen into place, but it didn't seem so at the time. Like everybody, I wanted to be a great actress. I hadn't realised I was actually very bad. I left school quite young because I went to a very, very horrible boarding school, but being quite bright, I did my A-levels very quickly and actually left school at 17 with everything, failed my Oxbridge entrance. But anyway, I thought, right, I'm going to go to drama school. Got turned down by drama school. I went to study music because I was very good at music, but it wasn't what I wanted to do, really. Applied from music school the next year to go to drama school, and they all remembered how bad I was. So I sort of studied music, but then dropped out. Then I did a short drama course at a drama school where they don't turn you away. But I realised I was not good at acting and tried to join the BBC, ironically, who then headhunted me about 5 years later. But they in those days would only take on people with double firsts in English from Oxbridge and that sort of thing, or you could go and be a secretary. And I was wise enough then to realise that that was going to be a dead end. So I went to a fantastic agency called Graduate Girls, who got me a job in independent television as a researcher, because they were much more adventurous, and if they liked you, they gave you a chance to get on. So I worked for ABC and then Thames Television in their research department, working on various programmes. Then I got a fantastic break where I went to become a literary agent at Curtis Brown, and I was assistant to someone in what was called the showbiz department, and we dealt with all sorts of writers and amazing people. Like, I was ringing up, you know, people like W.H. Auden and Lawrence Durrell and Daphne du Maurier and Samuel Beckett, all these giants. And without being too indiscreet, somebody I worked with there wasn't around a lot. So I did a lot of his job. And in fact, he then later was asked to leave. And so I took over, really very young, looking after all these amazing people. I mean, it was just the most fantastic break. I was only about 22, 23 when I went and did that. And so I worked for 3 years doing that and really having the most amazing time. You know, including things like ringing up W.H. Auden and asking him to appear on the Michael Parkinson show, which he did and then absolutely loathed it, which I knew he would. But, you know, it was a very, very varied job. I became very interested in radio drama. I think I thought it was just much more satisfying as a medium and started wanting to work more on that. And the agency weren't so keen on that because it wasn't so lucrative. And at roughly the same time, the BBC, I was having lunch with them, and someone was going off on leave, and they said, would you be interested in coming here on contract as a script editor? and it was just the right timing. So I left the agency and went to the BBC, where I worked for 2 years on two weekly contracts. I worked with really interesting people in the script unit there. People like John Madden, who's now a very famous film director, who directed the best exotic Marigold Hotel, and Peter Kosminski, who's very successful. Yeah. It was a fantastic job. And after 2 years on two-week contracts, where you literally, you know, you hung around Friday night, do you still want me on Monday, you know, I managed to get a job on the staff as a script editor. I think the great thing about radio there was that you weren't allowed to direct a play until you learnt how to edit a script. And as we all know, getting a script right before you direct it is absolutely vital. I didn't direct a play for probably 4 years. I wasn't allowed to direct them. I was only allowed to script edit them. And then I used to start by directing plays that weren't very good. You know, they always gave you something rubbish. Then slowly you started doing really good plays. And in fact, that was more frightening than doing a bad play.
Yeah.
You can only improve a bad play and you can only ruin a good one. So after a while, I then got a job as a staff, junior sort of staff director. And then about 4 years later, one of the senior directors was leaving, and having by then started to do really proper stuff there, I managed to get her job as a staff director there and worked there for, well, many, many years, including some of the time actually helping to run the team of producers.
Has it changed massively, the BBC?
Yes, I mean, the main change, which is the one that I think we all find quite difficult, is that in the what we call the old days, and it's not being old-fashioned, you know, the producer's enthusiasm for a project was absolutely pivotal. It was all based on trust. I mean, obviously, there were people who had mates who wrote radio plays and probably got them on the air. I mean, probably still the same today. But you could actually sell a play in a meeting verbally with your enthusiasm. Things got turned down, but everything was done on a rolling basis at a weekly meeting where producer directors would turn up. These days, it's all become very like television. I mean, it's all pitched on paper. It's very, very difficult to however enthusiastic or passionately you feel about a play, if you can't verbalise that and the decision is going to be made on something that is read on the page, it's much more difficult to actually sell projects.
With regard to career paths, you were an agent and then you sort of were asked to join the BBC. And then you ended up directing, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's almost sort of three little career shifts there.
Yeah.
Is that still, do things like that still happen? Is it possible to have that progression?
I think it is still possible. I mean, it's very difficult to learn how to be a director.
Mm.
It really is. And that's why, as I say, I think the first ground rules, you know, you need is to get a good script and to make sure you know how to script edit, because then, you know, the play will sort of play itself. I think you've got to know a lot about casting and things like that. Radio, you can't, if you miscast something on the radio, you completely had it. I was very nervous about becoming director because I'm actually naturally quite introverted. And the thought of standing up and telling people who I'd admired for years what to do was just terrifying. And I still get scared.
Yeah,
of course.
I've been doing it, for, you know, and as everybody says, the day you don't get scared, you give up.
Yeah. So you were talking earlier about your background a bit in music. Jeremy Howe recently said to me that no one mixes music and drama quite like you do. Why do you have such a skill at mixing the two, do you think?
I think for myself, I've always wanted to make programmes that are very, it sounds frightfully naff, very beautiful. I think radio is a fantastic medium. I think people with really wonderful voices, not beautiful necessarily, but I think there are some people who've got very dull voices, and so you tend to want to cast people who've got really quite musical voices sometimes. Music, to me, I've always thought that things can be enhanced and really made quite magical. Also, just moments in plays can be made quite wonderful by the right music. And to me, it's always been an exciting challenge to find the right bit of music for a play. And, you know, I would often say once I've found the music, I know how to do the play. I used to work with an editor in the days when we worked with faders and things, and she said, oh, you've got to do all your own fades, because I knew exactly where, and I mean literally to the nth second, where the speech should start.
Directing is almost like composition, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so, very much so. I mean, I do sort of think of it in quite a kind of musical kind of way. People always used to say, I knew 5 minutes in that it was one of your plays because of the music. And I usually like to take that as a compliment. I mean, I'm sure writers will think I've drowned some of their plays in music, but I'm very, very strict about music editing, and I annoy a lot of people when I'm doing my fine, fine editing, because they'll fiddle, you know, people like, you know, now that it's all digital, people say, or people will say, oh, I'll just cut a few bars out and then it'll fit well at the end. Well, sometimes that can work. But I can hear, you know, I know most of the music backwards and I can hear it, you know.
And with that in mind, Cherry, what's always surprised me about radio drama is how fast it's made. Do you ever feel, comparatively with other art forms, you know, where film edits can take, you know, months, do you know what I mean? You know, whereas radio, it's expected for a much higher turnaround, isn't it?
Yeah.
I sometimes feel like that's a bit unfair. Is that something you empathise with, or do you think...
Yes, I mean, there's something quite exciting about working very, very fast. It can be exciting, but there's an awful lot of compromise, I think. And I think the thing I most hate is having to record so quickly after a read-through. I mean, I really... sometimes in the old days when we had, say, 4 days to do a 90-minute play, in the days when there were 90-minute plays, you would rehearse for 3 days and you wouldn't record until the final day. And wow. that was wonderful, actually. And we also, I did plays in runs where I'd do a whole 90-minute play as a one continuous take with all the sound effects and the music. And I love working like that. And the thing I dislike most about the new way of working is that I'm not allowed to put the music on at the time of recording, because I was used to do that, and the actors were aware of that, and it's pretty nerve-wracking. But I often felt you got a better performance. For example, I did a play last year for Radio 4, and I wanted to put the music on at the time, and the actor, I think, wanted to put the music on at the time, but we were sort of told it would be easier to put it on later. Well, it wasn't.
And there is almost, as someone, I say this as someone who's never ever worked with anything but digital, but there almost is the curse of the digital editor to assume that you can actually do something after the event when actually you can't, because you can't adjust the amount of time an actor takes to say the lines. I guess what I'm asking is, you know, is this something that's happening more and more at the BBC? Is digital sort of almost in a way supplanting, you know, the sort of skills that maybe 20, 30 years ago were commonplace?
I think there is a huge false economy in terms of saving money, because I think by not putting everything on at the time and saying we can do all that later, I think you often end up spending more money than you would have done in the studio in editing time, because editing time isn't free. I think it should be more flexible depending on the project and the director and everything else.
During the time you were at the BBC, Cherry, what sort of changes did you see?
Well, I was there for, I think it was about 34 years, something amazing like that. Huge changes. I mean, absolutely huge changes. I mean, a very simple thing. In the old days, we had studios where we had, if you wanted echo on something, there was an echo chamber, mm-hmm. which was in the basement at Broadcasting House. And you had to say to the person, I want echo in this scene, and they'd fade up this echo chamber. The famous story once that they faded it up when there was a couple having sex in the echo chamber. I don't know if that was true. Everybody in those days had a lot more fun, and they all drank a lot. I mean, it was quite interesting. But I mean, you know, when I first joined there, and there were these kind of iconic people still there, it was an amazing place to work, but people were quite often the worst for wear quite a lot of the time. We all smoked like anything. You know, people drank at lunchtime. People enjoyed it all. There was a huge sense of enjoyment. I think there's a slight climate of fear at the moment. And part of me, having now had to leave and working independently, part of me in a way thinks I'm relieved I'm not dealing with some of the pressures. I mean, rather like the National Health Service, the amount of bureaucracy. I directed a play for the department just after I'd left, and I had to come in and do a 4-hour online health and safety module on a computer, which couldn't be done at home. Well, that just says it all, doesn't it? There's a lot of false economy, I think, these days, to be honest. I think if they trusted, say, the director now, and the director said, right, I need, you know, an extra half day in the studio and it'll cost less in the long run or whatever, there's far too many people interfering with how you work, really.
A lot of what we've just been talking about with regards to the culture surrounding radio drama and the people and all that sort of stuff, and thinking back to what I know of the BBC before I was born, you know, stuff like the Radiophonic Workshop and the kind of the stuff they were doing with sound effects and things like that, and looking at what I know of it now, would you say that when we're thinking about the future, that actually a degree of experimentation has been lost?
Yes, I mean, I worked a lot with the Radiophonic Workshop, and I worked a great deal with one of the best people in it, Elizabeth Parker, who also wrote a lot of music for the plays that I did. And it was a very misogynistic world, I have to say. And as a woman director, I had a lot of problems with some of the people there. But there was something wonderful about them. And they were, before certain changes in the BBC, they were a free resource. If you were doing a play that needed radiophonic sounds, you rang them up, you went and worked with them, they worked with you. It was all part of the BBC. Then it became something that you had to pay for. Then it became sort of phased out. Then it didn't exist anymore. It's very, very sad because it was a very exciting way of working. It's a whole world lost. It was very innovative. Now it's all a bit clinical.
Taking that into account, obviously, you know, with the new technology that they have now, the internet, downloading that kind of stuff, what do you think the future, do you think there is a future for radio drama, and what do you think the future is?
Well, I think there's a huge future for radio drama. I certainly think, I'd like to think there's a huge pressure at the moment to get a younger audience. I don't think it's, well, obviously with what Wireless Theatre Company is doing is fantastically good at doing that. It's quite difficult for the BBC to actually manage to do that. And I don't think some of the programmes they make to try and get a younger audience sort of quite kind of work. But yeah, I think it's just a question of keeping people aware of radio drama and huge, you know, publicity and everything. I wish there were more programmes on television about radio drama. I think it's a fantastic medium. It's hugely underrated, and I think, you know, there a lot more could be done to make programs about radio, because I think people are genuinely fascinated about how it works, and certainly teaching young new actors acting, they haven't got a clue about how do you do a screen kiss, you know, how do you do a kiss on the radio, you know, how do you do this, that, the other, you know, they're absolutely fascinated by it.
How do you do a kiss on the radio?
Well, some actors like to do the real thing if they fancy. You leave it up to the actors. I've always left it up to the actors, and I've seen everything from quite a lot, I can tell you. I think it's all in the breathing. Heavy breathing and sort of nostling into the... yes, a lot of all that. You actually have to almost have an orgasm in order to sound like you're having a kiss.
And what's next for you, Joe?
Well, I hope Manchester United are going to beat Blackburn. looking at kick-off time. I've just directed a play for Radio 3, which goes out the beginning, just before Wimbledon starts. It's a very anarchic comedy, starring Alex Jennings and Celia Imrie and Michael Maloney and lots of other wonderful people, which we did on location on a real tennis court. And I'm doing a play later this year about Rachmaninoff for Radio 4. Next year I'm doing another big play for Radio 3 about Wagner and Verdi.
Lovely.
And hopefully some more work for the Wireless Theatre Company.
Of course!
We hope so. We very much hope so. Jerry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Not at all. Thank you.
Brilliant.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.